Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, we'll have a look at the front pages and it's game on, really, in terms of the presidential election now, in that the various stories about the various candidates across the papers. So the Sunday Times are leading with Humphreys hit by fresh claims from ex-official. And this is the story that's been out there already, but that they have kind of new angles on, which is, look, it's a complicated story, so we'll explain it properly in a minute, all right? Irish Mail on Sunday have a story about what they say is a dirty tricks campaign hitting Jim Gavin's Fianna Fáil Áras bid. And again, we'll explain that in a minute. The Sunday Independent have a poll. They're saying there's a deadlock in the Áras race as poll shows opening for Sinn Féin, and we will come to that too, obviously. The Business Post leading with slow, costly and high tax, how US officials rate Irish economy. Now, this is from the US Department of State, headed up by Marco Rubio. So, you know, we would say, wouldn't we, in this country that, oh, you know, these MAGA people and everything. But, like, Ireland suffers from chronic infrastructure problems, a persistent housing crisis and a tedious planning system, American investors have been warned. We'd probably be hard pushed to argue that strongly against that characterisation in ways. The Sun on Sunday is leading with a story that has kind of broken over yesterday afternoon, evening and this morning, and to the extent that the papers haven't probably gone as much on it as they would. But it's cops hunt Harris stalker, Simon's kids family targeted. A sick new threat has been made against a member of Simon Harris's family. An Instagram post threatened a very close relative. And then the Mirror and the Sunday World are leading with stories about the father of the missing boy. So, our panel this morning, Jack Horgan-Jones is political correspondent at the Irish Times. Professor Niamh Horrigan is Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College. Peter Brown is the Managing Director of Bagot Investment Partners, and Tanya Ward is Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning.
Jack, would you just, the Sunday Independent has this story as well, it's on the front of the Sun. New sinister threat against Harris's family, his bid to intimidate him out of office, says Harris is the Sunday Indo's taken it. So just, Simon Harris is very angry, isn't he?
He is, and you can really feel that anger coming across in the statement which was released last night. As you said in your introduction, Brendan, this kind of fell between two stools in terms of the news cycle. So it was kind of late yesterday afternoon that we heard about this first. So apart from the Sun on Sunday, which has splashed on it, we don't have a huge amount of coverage in it. But I think it's an important and significant story, not least because it's the second time, by my count, in less than a week, there's been a very serious threat made against the family of Simon Harris. We know that there was a threat, an online threat, made to kidnap his children in the last week or so, and in the aftermath of that he released a pretty short statement. But we now have a second threat against the close family member, the Sun reporting that it threatened sexual violence, that it's been referred onto obviously the Gardaí, who are seeking information from the social media platform concerned, and it's expected that they're going to trace the IP address of the person who sent the alleged threat. But the statement, I think, from Simon Harris is where the meat of this is. It's quite long, it's a couple of hundred words. He starts talking about how, you know, he got into politics, he expected the kind of rough and tumble, but that this falls far outside those normal bounds. He says that it is a campaign of intimidation, and that there's a clear and sinister pattern to it, and also that there's a clear intent behind it, in his estimation, which is that the motivation is to intimidate him out of office. It lands on an interesting note. The last couple of lines talk about how he's going to pull together people from not just government and Fine Gael, but across politics to see what they could do. But the very last line talks about how he'll be led in what he does next by his family.
Protecting my family is my number one priority. I'll be guided by them on next steps.
What, yeah.
What, What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I'm only inferring, but on the face of it, it sounds to me like, you know, he's going to consult with his family. And if I put out a statement like that, you know, I'd be saying if my family wants me to step back from this, and I'm only kind of inferring or analysing what's there on the face, but I've no real insight into what he's thinking, then that's something I might have to consider, you know.
And he put it in there, didn't he?
Yes, I think so. And you know, there's an obvious broader discussion which we've been having in studios like this and in newspapers up and down the country for several years now about the nature of political discourse and the kind of both disinhibiting and disintermediating effects of online abuse. You know, people feel they can say things online, and then they also have the opportunity to do this directly, either to politicians or in these instances to their families themselves. And there's a wider kind of curdling of the public discourse and the political discourse that's gone underway. It's around the margins, it's not in the mainstream, but it's something that has become part of mainstream politicians' lives day to day. It's something that we covered in the Irish Times yesterday.
Yeah, Tanya, we saw in the Irish Times yesterday one politician has given police access to their phone in order to, you know, figure out who's threatening them. Politicians saying that they are getting abuse about everything from Israel to housing to whatever, when they're out in the supermarket, when they're at the GPs. TD's been told, at least warned anyway, but don't go into town when you're inside in Leinster House. Don't go outside Leinster House and go around the city and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it is really starting to become the norm for politicians, and it's just not acceptable or good enough. I mean, I really appreciate Simon Harris speaking out on this, and Mary Lou came out earlier as well about similar threats. And there's a lot of politicians who are afraid to go public about the kind of threats that they're living with, either in person or they're online.
The ones in the Irish Times yesterday didn't want to give their names because we don't want to seem as if we're victims. And the Irish Times noted one politician who had spent thousands on security for their homes. Yeah. They're entitled to get money back for that, but didn't put in for the money because just didn't want anyone to know this.
That's it, because they're afraid they're going to have copycat attacks on them. That's what they're actually afraid. That's why they're all keeping their head down in relation to it. But the truth is, it's actually having an effect on politics, because I think Simon Harris' last statement is very telling. I'll have to consult with my family about what happens next. I mean, there is a real issue that we could change the contours of political life if we don't deal with these threats and harassment that the politicians
have. Have you had this kind of thing as a person who's in the public eye and commenting on things?
Unfortunately, I have, to be honest. And last year, based on something that happened in actually a youth conference, would you believe, I got a huge amount of onslaught against me online. And unfortunately, it resulted in some threats, you know, and then commentary on my ethnicity and the ethnicity of my children. And to be honest, it didn't bother me in a way. And you probably won't believe that, but it didn't. But what did bother me was I worried about my kids. And it meant I had to have a conversation with my kids about it, and I had to take it seriously. And of course, the board takes it seriously. I mean, everyone takes it seriously. My friends contacted me saying, I keep on reporting the threats, and I said, don't bother. Just let people see it for what it is. Don't bother doing it. The platforms won't do anything about it. But it does change political life. And I remember at the time having conversations with politicians about it, talking to the Gardaí about it, talking to journalists about it. And it's actually mostly politicians and journalists who have been targeted online in this way. But one of the things I love about political life in Ireland, and it's because we live in a small country like Ireland, is that you can meet your politician and you can have a conversation with them. And actually, you can challenge them on issues, on their performance, and they'll engage with you. If we don't deal with this effectively, we're going to change what political life looks like. And the people who come forward for politics will change as well. Yeah. If you've got children and young people
who have come forward for politics, is this something that was in the calculus for you when you were thinking about running?
It was. I think the significant thing, and it's interesting now because we've the presidential election coming up, and that again is what's known as a second tier election, a bit like the European elections. And I think you actually... Certainly, there was a very high proportion of, you know, abuse and going on in that online. But I think the significant thing Brendan, is because that pattern of online abuse is actually quite established now. It's been going on for a while. And if somebody puts their hand up and says, I'm going forward for election, there's a pretty much expectation that you're going to take that
on
the chin.
Did you A, expect it, and B, did you get it?
I did A, expect it, and B, did get it. But what I think is, and I suppose this is quite sociological, when you drop the norms of normal behaviour in the online space, there's actually not that far to when that starts to drop in the real life. And I suppose that has taken time to play out in Ireland, but certainly
we've seen two MPs shot
in the European election. It did play out. Do you know what I mean? And there was like almost a physical dimension to it at times, certainly when you'd be out campaigning. And I think that's what's so helpful about what Simon Harris is saying, is he is willing to go on the record. Actually, I think his anger is really helpful.
And he had already said during the week, I'm no longer maintaining a dignified silence about this. He clearly decided, there's enough of us not talking about it.
And I think it is about this thing of, there is a requirement for structural reform. There is, you know, putting a line in the sand and saying, because it is a threat to democracy. And we will lose that intimacy with politicians if we don't deal with it. So something structurally has to be done.
Peter.
Yeah, I mean, the point that we've seen two fatalities of political figures in the UK just emphasises how serious this actually is. The threat that could lead to a leader in politics in this country resigning, I think, would be a much bigger event than just an Irish event. I think it could be across the board in terms of a political event. It could be a huge event.
Yeah.
But I think the answer here has to be in the legislation on these platforms, that this information is readily available if threats to people's livelihood or their families are made, that these platforms have got to release that information. They have it instantaneously, this information, right? They have to give that information instantaneously, and then people have to be followed up and prosecuted on it.
Okay. Look, we'll move on to the presidential elections because there's a lot about it today. But Jack, can I ask you first? The nomination process in the local authority starts tomorrow in Kerry. Is there any point in any of it? Because Fine Gael have already come out and said their members are whipped to oppose, which suggests that they are not even allowed to abstain to maybe allow someone to come through their council. And Fianna Fáil are saying to us that they want to get Tuesday over them first when they pick their candidate, and then they will issue a directive. But there seems to be a general assumption they will issue a similar directive. So does that mean the whole county council's nomination process is dead in the water?
I mean, it certainly makes it what was already a pretty narrow path that bit narrower. As you say, Fine Gael have whipped their councillors. Fianna Fáil are holding fire. But look, it's interesting. It's very hard to predict because there's layers of local politics and layers of tribal and party politics kind of woven into each other when it comes to the contest and the local authorities. Take, for example, the fact that some cohort of Fianna Fáil councillors seem to be pretty annoyed about being disenfranchised from the selection process for the Fianna Fáil candidate. And that was evident in pieces that were written and broadcast last week. So I suppose the question is, if Fianna Fáil were to hand down a diktat, to what extent would that be obeyed? There may also be truth within Fine Gael about that. How closely will that whip be adhered to? Politics at local level is volatile, it's hard to predict. There is, you know, blocking majorities on many councils for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and let's not forget that the left parties also have a combined candidate in the field. So that's why it makes it a narrow path. But you wouldn't quite be ruling it out just yet that it could be a pathway for somebody. And let's also remember that sometimes announcing yourself as a presidential candidate is not necessarily with a realistic chance of getting on the ballot paper that goes to the electorate. It's also to use it as a kind of political platform to talk about the issues that you or your supporters are interested in. And this will be an opportunity for that. So I think the likes of Kerry, I think Fingal is later in the week, and I think particularly the very big councils, Dublin City Council and so on, when they're addressed by these putative candidates, that's a political moment, and it's one that will travel, even if the chances of translating that onto being on the ballot paper are pretty slim.
Okay, Niamh, you picked Gary Murphy in the Sunday Times. Let only serious runners get within reach of the oars. One question, though, is, are the big parties and the big candidates, say we have three at the moment, potentially four if Sinn Féin put in a candidate, are they not better off spreading the field a bit and it spreads a bit of flack and having a few more people in there for debates and everything else?
I don't think so, Brendan. I think if you look at the global political context and the threat of interference in elections, which is significant and is evidenced and is proved, I actually think, and Gary refers to, I suppose, the thinking of those who designed the process for the state. I actually think it's really good that councillors have a route to elect a candidate. I don't think we'll see anyone coming out of that route this time around, but I think it's really good that it's there. But I also think it's good that there isn't a mechanism whereby some external agency can come in and relatively easily manipulate the process. And I think that's really what Gary is trying to get at on that piece. I have to say, I do think, given this election, I think it's going to take place on the 24th of October. I mean, it's getting quite late in the day now for particularly Sinn Féin to make a call on this. And I mean, this is the speculation across the papers today is...
We'll come to that. Yeah, okay. There's a story about Heather Humphreys, and there's a story about Jim Gavin. Heather Humphreys on the front of the Sunday Times, and Jim Gavin is on the front of the Mail. So, will we look at the Jim Gavin story first? Jack, will you just explain it then? And Tanya, I know you want to talk about it then.
Sure. So this image of Jim Gavin appears to have been in circulation, where he's photographed next to Eimear Higgins back in 2019. Eimear Higgins is currently the TD for Dublin West and a Fine Gael junior minister. And apparently this image was doing the rounds in Fianna Fáil WhatsApp groups, in Fine Gael WhatsApp groups as well last night. Now, one of the papers has it today that the version of the image where they're standing next to each other was doctored to kind of make it look to be more supportive of Eimear Higgins.
So I think the story is he took a picture with her at one stage, as he has, his people would say, with tens of thousands of people. She then seems to have, at the time, put livery around it saying, you know, vote number one on Friday for her. But and we've asked Fianna Fáil, and they say Jim Gavin was unaware of this until Thursday, when they became aware of it as well. So this was circulating back then. It's now been circulating frantically in the last day or two.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not even clear as to when that livery is supposed to be applied. Was it back then? And it wouldn't be unheard of for local election candidates to have a photograph taken with a high profile person, and for that then to laterally appear on their campaign literature, even if the high profile person wasn't aware of it. So I'm not clear, was the livery applied back then, or was it more recently? I suppose that the politics of this are what's interesting. The Mail has dirty tricks. I think it's heavy politicking anyway, because you have, you know, obviously there's a cohort within Fianna Fáil which is supportive of Billy Kelleher, and they may be kind of gently pushing this and saying, you know, is Jim Gavin, you know, is he as Fianna Fáil as we might like to think? You know, he's obviously only recently joined the party, but, you know, what if in fact he was closer to Fianna Fáil?
So an attempt to sow some little seeds of doubt there.
And that's been driven as well, I think, a little bit. There's some off-record comments in the Mail as well from Fine Gael people. Let's not forget that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are in coalition together, but they are in opposition against each other in this election. Fine Gael ministers apparently saying to the Mail on Sunday, you know, we thought Jim Gavin was one of ours.
Yeah, and they've been saying that for the last few
heavy
weeks. Heavy politicking. Tanya?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting piece, and it's kind of predictable, because this is what happens in the presidential elections, is everything you ever did and never said will come out into the public domain. And I think the implication is here, oh, is there a connection here with Fianna Gael? I mean, I didn't know who Jim Gavin was until he was announced, and that doesn't mean anything because I just don't follow sports. And I looked up his profile. I was thinking, God, this is really impressive profile, long track record in public service. I was thinking, God, why didn't he run in the Dáil? Is actually one of my first question in relation to it. But this is part of these presidential elections, and I think for Jim Gavin he's going to experience this throughout the campaign. I mean, he comes across as a very credible candidate, there's no doubt about it, but it's a very tough area of politics, and the kind of skill set you need is very different to what you might have used in public service. I mean, it's interesting, I think, and I think the Irish public have no space for any kind of nonsense candidates. They generally veer towards conservative, risk averse choices when the election comes up, and I think for Jim Gavin,
Michael D. Higgins was not risk averse. It was, you know, the
but
great phrase about him was he'd go crazy if he ever went
them, right?
into office.
So, yeah, you knew what you got, because the thing
he
is
a known entity though. You do what you were getting.
With Jim Gavin, you don't really know his political views yet, because most of the time he's been in public service, so you know he wouldn't be here on this show commenting. But I think one of the things I'll be interested to see if he gets through Tuesday, which it looks like he probably will, be interested to see what his other skills are like. You know, that ability to communicate with the public, stand up in the campaign without alienating anyone, and that ability to have that instant connection with the public. I mean, all of that is really important. If you look at how Michael D did so well, my daughter at the age of 7 met Michael D up in the Oris. She still talks about it. You know, she queued up like everyone else. He shook the hand, he talked to her, and he made her feel special. That's part of the presidency.
Yeah, and there are lots of stories about Jim Gavin going around of people who met him and felt that it felt very special afterwards as well. Okay, so Jack, the Heather Humphrey story. So this is not a new story. Can you talk us through what the Sunday Times are saying today and be fair to everyone involved? And I will intervene as needed.
So this stretches all the way back to 2020, actually. John Mooney, who's the investigations editor of the Sunday Times, first wrote a version of this story just as COVID was coming over the horizon, and perhaps it lost a bit of prominence then. Effectively, the facts of the story are that an inspector in the Department of Agriculture visited a farm in County Monaghan. The farmer concerned had a history of facing allegations of animal cruelty. I think this was for the third time an inspection had kind of identified potential incidents in that space. And there was a case proceeding against the farmer, and as Sunday Times reports this morning, that the expectation was that if this prosecution was successful, there would be a lifetime ban handed down against the farmer concerned. So in the middle of all this, Heather Humphreys, who's from the same constituency as this farmer is located in, receives a letter seemingly from the family of this farmer concerned, and passes it on to...
Passed on by a constituency worker in her office, we're told.
Passed on by a constituency, so her office rather than her personally, yeah. Correct. Passed it on to the Department of Agriculture. I mean, what happens thereafter, I suppose, the exact line of causation is a matter of conjecture or
contention.
But
there was a review within a couple of days of the case, the case was dropped within...
Correct. The facts of the matter are a review was initiated, and thereafter... The case was discontinued. Now, at the time, you know, there were various different reasons offered internally, which are outlined in Freedom of Information requests, which were released to John Mooney as to why the case was dropped. Initially, it was offered that, you know, it was for legal reasons and then for policy reasons. It's all a bit muddled and unclear. But what is interesting is that the inspector, the Department of Agriculture inspector, who was at the centre of this, has broken his silence in the Sunday Times today and has gone on record, and he is interviewed and kind of gives his version of events.
And Heather Humphreys, again today, she has dealt with this story most recently on the News at One during the week, but the statement from her spokesman is the Secretary General of that department, Department of Agriculture, she was not the Minister for Agriculture at the time, note, stated clearly at a Public Accounts Committee that no representation whatsoever was made in relation to the case. Heather does not know either of these people personally. The only contact she had ever had with either individual is the letter which a staff member in her constituency office forwarded to the Department of Agriculture without comment. Niamh, is this kind of stuff damaging potentially? I mean, people might not follow the detail of this thing as assiduously and as fairly as we are this morning.
Yes.
But
I think it is. I think there is a challenge if you're a politician with a relatively long history or a long career in Ireland, and particularly one who's held a senior ministry, to keep across everything and to see that there's no landmines in the whole lot of it, I think would be very unusual. I think a lot will be about how she deals with this when she's asked about it, and it unquestionably will come up in the debates. But also, I think it's generally about the cumulative effect of how people deal with things over the course of the campaign. To be fair, this may be one of the reasons why Fianna Fáil are attracted to a candidate like Jim Gavin, who is a relatively unknown quantity. The danger is that once they're in, you know, if they win and they're in the hot seat, then you're not quite sure how they're going to respond when they're under pressure. I suppose the flip side of having someone who's had a long political career is you've kind of a fair idea where the nooks and crannies are when you actually, when they're in office. So it'll be up. I mean, to be fair, Brendan, I think the Irish public have made fairly astute selections during, and they're a fairly good judge in this particular space, despite the campaign, which can be dirty and at times can be silly, of course, as well.
Yeah, Tanya, would you agree that people see through any kind of what were you calling it, Jack? Extreme politicking
and heavy politicking.
Heavy politicking.
Oh yeah, completely. And you can see that. You can see that when they're polled about their choices for the presidency. I mean, what they want is they want someone that knows the constitution. They want someone with a bit of political experience. They want someone with a good record of public service, and they want someone who knows how to behave appropriately in the right circumstance. They know well that the presidency can't be used to really have
fix housing.
Exactly, fix housing, fix anything. If you want, you're standing for the wrong election, and I think they'll end up making a conservative choice. The one thing I do think about this election, though, I don't think there's a tolerance from the public to have all these nonsense candidates that and I'm not saying they all are, but there's a couple of candidates that really are only trying to exploit it for their own self interest.
Because you brought up the poll there, we'll move on to that. So there's a poll, Ireland Thinks poll, today in the Sunday Independent, conducted on Friday, and the sample size was 1,162 people. The margin of error is plus or minus 3%. So you alluded there to that in terms of, people say anyway, their most important factor for considering their vote in the presidential election is knowledge of the constitution. 42% of people saying that's what they'll be making their decision on. Okay. Jack, in terms of, they have a couple of different versions of ballot papers here. So in terms of the runners and riders.
Yeah, three horse race, and very, very, very tight between them amongst the three either confirmed or presumably confirmed candidates, being Heather Humphreys, confirmed for Fine Gael, Catherine Connolly, the confirmed candidate for the combined left opposition, and Jim Gavin, the putative Fianna Fáil candidate. Heather on 21, Catherine Connolly on 20, and Jim Gavin on 20. So not a huge amount to call between them. What is interesting, though, I suppose, is when they start kind of unspooling the different permutations that arise from whether Sinn Féin put a candidate in the field.
Okay.
Most interestingly, what it does to Catherine Connolly's vote. So they polled those three plus Mary Lou MacDonald. And in that instance, Mary Lou MacDonald leapfrogs over Catherine Connolly to 17% support, which would suggest that, given the presumed transfer patterns that would exist between the two, if a Sinn Féin candidate, be it Mary Lou MacDonald or someone else, were to stay ahead of Catherine Connolly, that would kind of put paid to Catherine Connolly's chances, and conversely throw Sinn Féin into the...
go to Sinn Féin.
Yeah, and conversely throw Sinn Féin into the final kind of shake up between the last two or three.
Okay. Sorry, Peter, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to see, I know this campaign, Race for the Oris, is heavily political, right? However, I come from the camp that doesn't hold a particular political view. So I'm looking for somebody.
Follow the money, basically.
Yeah, I'm looking for somebody, right, that has the qualities, the intellect, the charisma, the superb narration skills, and the likability that Michael D had. Now, I'm willing to accept...
Narration skills, so to tell the nation a story about itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a figurehead job.
Yeah.
It's a figurehead job.
Really.
Say something meaningful, be able to communicate. They're the skills we're looking for. Now, I know we're not going to get a Michael
D. But you're wrong. People, knowledge of the Constitution.
And knowledge knowledge of the Constitution. Absolutely, knowledge of the Constitution, so you don't say something you shouldn't. But... I accept the fact I'm not going to get another Michael D. I accept that, right? So the candidates, I'm not going to hold them to that level of standard. But I'm not seeing anything. I'm underwhelmed, right? I'm not seeing anyone stand out here that I think represents the nation, speaks properly, kind of, you know, has that skill set that Michael D. had.
Okay, I think you've been equally unfair to all of them there, so I can leave that's it. Are you excited, Niamh? Of course, as a member of the Labour Party, your candidate is Catherine Connolly.
Yeah, she is indeed,
So are you part of the... you show your age here now. Are you part of the older guard of the Labour Party who are apparently not that keen on Catherine Connolly, or a member of the younger guard who are apparently more keen?
Well, I suppose my own view, Brendan, from the perspective of the left, is that the opportunity that this election presents is an opportunity to unify. Like, if you look across Europe, the right is unifying. The right is unified in Ireland. If the left don't unify, we're looking at being sitting on the opposition benches. And there's tremendous support across the left for that process of unification. So for that reason, I am supportive of Labour supporting Catherine Connolly's run for the presidential bid. Yes,
okay,
I am.
OK, Tanya?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree with Peter. It's not clear who the contender is, but these are all flying candidates.
To get people
out to vote, basically, you have to give them a reason, because it could affect turnout. But most of them haven't gotten, they're only getting their campaign going right now. And I think once the media, that kind of final 3-4 weeks happens and we're just walking into it, I think it'll really flush out who has the right
skill set. To capture the imagination.
That's it.
Mary McAleese came into the campaign relatively late in the day, relatively unknown, and won. You know, so it can be an unexpected campaign in many ways.
I mean, it's in a way, you know, when the polls are like this, it's kind of exciting, right? Because the campaign can go any kind of way. And even for Sinn Féin, who you would have said you held back too late, this is kind of saying it's actually okay. If you put a strong candidate in now, you still have a chance.
Okay. So on that, I'll bring you back in a sec, Jack. Niamh, you picked two stories about. One in the Sunday Times, Sinn Féin TDs tell Macdonald not to stand. And then Shane Coleman in the Business Post, who was, I think, to give him credit, the first person who said Mary Lou Macdonald should run for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I took a lot of flack for it at the time, if I remember.
He's saying moment of truth for Sinn Féin as it considers Oris move for Mary Lou.
So it's so interesting what's happening at the moment, because if it's kind of a Hobson's choice, if Sinn Féin run Mary Lou and if she doesn't win, her political capital is damaged. There's just no question about that. And yet at the same time, she seems to be the candidate who has the best chance of winning. So really, it's a question for them of, A, do they want Mary Lou in the Oris? Where, to be fair, I remember actually Mary O'Rourke saying to me about Michael D years ago when he was running his, he'll be very spancelled in the Oris. Now, he actually turned out to be not that spancelled in the Oris, but being president is a spancelling process. So do they want her there? The other thing, I suppose, and this is the question, is outside
of... But in terms of telling the nation a story, and their big thing is that the president needs to be a United Irelander, and that probably is a big, you know, that is a big narrative that a president could possibly...
But I, to be honest, I think any of the three candidates who are declared there in their own different ways could narrate a theme about how they would embody that.
I think the question for Sinn Féin,
it's a bit like the Jim Gavin question, is will Mary Lou appeal to those outside of a core Sinn Féin vote, because she'll need them to get over the line.
Okay.
Well,
might attract them for
Sinn Féin, because obviously there's a real risk. But things are unfolding on the island of Ireland, and being in the presidency for the next two terms will be very significant and in helping the country work out what needs to happen.
Okay.
Putting the right things in place and promoting inclusion and unity.
And Peter, look, Sinn Féin aren't the only party who have problems around this. In fairness, Fianna Fáil, this has all been a bit scrappy for them as well. You picked Shane Ross's piece today. Micheál Martin leaves the great peacemaker in no man's land.
Yeah, I think Bertie's been unfairly treated here, right? And I mean, Bertie is solely held out as responsible for the crash, right? And clearly, the crash was not Bertie's issue. The crash was the banking. It was bankers who caused the crash, and the hundreds of risk managers who were employed in those banks who sold their principals for money.
Bankers offered financial regulation
So the issue was, right, Bertie ended up in an economy, right, that was out of control, with a central bank that couldn't raise rates to calm it down. That was the economic reality of what happened. It's unrealistic to turn around to and ask a politician to just crash the economy. That's not going to happen. The banks have a fiduciary responsibility they completely ignored. Completely ignored, with all these 100% mortgages, interest-only mortgages, all these lending practices that they completely ignored. The central bank were hamstrung.
None of this was illegal when they were doing it. They were doing it in plain sight. There were ads for 100% mortgages everywhere.
Yeah,
it wasn't as if the banks were acting nefariously. Within a very loose regulatory framework that allowed it.
Banks have a fiduciary responsibility to their customers, to their shareholders, to act in a responsible manner. 100% mortgages in a booming economy is not responsible at anyone's anyone's, and it proven to be absolutely correct. Interest-only mortgage, giving somebody a mortgage they can never repay if it had to be principal plus interest. That's not responsible. So I think Bertie got beaten up on that and is still beaten up on that. You know, he has some qualities. I'm not saying I'm a huge Bertie fan, but I just think he's been unfairly treated. Right.
Okay.
Now,
does anyone disagree?
I think
the one thing Micheál Martin had to do this year was to keep Bertie Hearn out of that race for this, for like Fianna Fáil. I mean, as somebody who's not a member of Fianna Fáil, I'd have loved to see Bertie run. But if you were in Fianna Fáil, it would have been a kamikaze move to run Bertie.
I mean, the other point, Bertie, and you're talking about United Ireland and all those sort of issues, that he was the ideal candidate for that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think people can make a persuasive case over Bertie Hearn being potentially a good president, but like, it's politics. You have to also survive the campaign trail. And notwithstanding everything that you've said there about the overriding global financial situation that did hit the state, and that is a factor, you know, there was also the fiscal stance of the Ahern governments heading into this. There was also the "when I have it, I spend it" McCreevynomics, all of which Bertie Ahern presided over, all of which was not just a contributory factor, but also a causal factor.
Yeah,
and
people will argue that they were unlucky to have been in power and been able to do it, that all the other parties were only screaming for more.
Well, look, that's a counterfactual. Yeah. At the end of the day, there is one
particular thing I want to ask you about, which is the John Deasy has an interesting piece in the Business Post. Secret ballot on Gavin puts Martin Fianna Fáil leadership in spotlight. A, does Billy Kelleher have a chance here? And B, even if Billy Kelleher doesn't win it but gets substantial support, is it bad for Micheál Martin?
Billy Kelleher does not have a great chance. I think that his support in the secret ballot, if it comes to that, and that's one of the interesting things that John Deasy is probing in his Business Post piece, because he suggests that people around Micheál Martin will do everything in their power to avoid a secret ballot, including trying to get Billy Kelleher to drop out between now and then. That would be really fascinating. But I think his support in that secret ballot, if it comes to pass, will be stronger than his 6-odd declared votes that he has, including himself. I think the question for Micheál Martin is, will it raise above the threshold of people rallying to Kelleher so he's not embarrassed, you know, so it doesn't look bad for someone who is a stalwart of the party, and get towards a threshold where, you know, this could be interpreted as a bit of a kicking for Micheál Martin, a bit of a rejection of how he's prosecuted putting together the Fianna Fáil election campaign. And this is, or not election campaign rather, but the choice of the candidate. And this is something that John Deasy is good. He's kind of pulling together, you know, the sequence of events and the very strong suspicion that people across the political spectrum have that Micheál Martin would probably have been happy not to run a candidate. The fact that the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party did want to run a candidate, and the fact that Billy Kelleher kind of gave voice to that a few weeks ago. All that ended up in a situation where Billy Kelleher unanticipately ends up on the pitch.
Yeah, but we don't know that. Jim Gavin was apparently being spoken to back in the summer.
One Fianna Fáil TD told me they first heard his name as far back as July. You know,
yeah,
so
okay,
I mean,
okay.
So
we don't know that it was that much of an emergency.
Mind,
okay, we'll take a break there. I think we've interrogated all that very well. Jack Horgan-Jones, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Peter Brown and Tanya Ward staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Jack Horgan-Jones, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Peter Brown and Tanya Ward, and of course the other big story of the week that I think has really gripped the nation is the missing boy. Tanya, Ali Bracken in the Sunday Independent probably has the most comprehensive, up-to-date telling of what we know. So will you just give us that first, maybe, and then I'll take your thoughts.
So, I mean, I was really surprised to read this, to be honest, because I've been following all the story, but this is very detailed. What we know from this story is that obviously a child was reported missing, and the Department of Social Protection is the one that, through child benefit checks, brings it to Tusla's attention. When it was reported to the Gardaí obviously made contact with the parents. And what we understand happened was the mum and dad were living in shared accommodation when the mum became pregnant and decided that they couldn't keep the child because they were living in such an insecure housing situation, and they placed the child for voluntary care. So there's no care order as such. They contacted Tusla, they reached out, they asked to put the child into the care system. with a view to adoption. And it seems a year and a half later, the mother changed her view. She had much better housing and she wanted to raise the child herself, and that Tusla worked with her to return the child to her and into her care. And at some point, when the child is around the age of two, what we understand happened was the child died. What the story says is that that both parents have been interviewed in relation to this, and they are both saying slightly different stories, but they're both saying the child died of natural causes. The mother talked about finding the child in bed cold, and she put him in the bath to try and revive him. Instead of contacting the authorities, the child was placed in a holdall and brought to a field and buried in Dunabate. And it's only when the Department of Social Protection does its checks on the child benefit claim that the child's disappearance comes to light.
Okay. I saw you talking in some newspaper article during the week about that, like, okay, so Tusla have said, look,
what happened to this little boy. I can only think for all the people that loved him, how difficult, and for his community,
how difficult this is. And we might think of, I think he was with two different foster families as well, and we might think of them today because we know that foster families can have a real bond with children. But in terms of Tusla say there was nothing else to see, there were no concerns, so you know, we left it at that. I saw you talking about how COVID was a problem, maybe not in this case specifically, but in general, that the state and agencies basically lost track of all kinds of vulnerable children.
That's right. I mean, and we don't know whether COVID is part of the story here or not, because what did happen when we had the first lockdown, I have 160 plus member organisations. I can't tell you how many phone calls I got from people that worked on the front line providing child protection services and family support services, who were really angry about closing the schools and closing the early year services. And the reason is the whole child protection system is built on having contact with frontline service agencies who are able to tell Tusla when a child is actually at risk.
So the conduit is schools and early childhood.
Family members, the Gardaí. So remember, people didn't have contact with their family members.
Okay,
grandparents
so
didn't see the
whole network just shut down.
Yeah. And the question here is what happened around this network of this child? I mean, there's a positive in this case in that the Department of Social Protection alerted Tusla. And I think there's something to be done following up. This is an example of very good practice. But what happened with all the other services?
There was actually joined up thinking in this case. Too late, but there was. Niamh, I think that the simple question that a lot of people keep coming back to is how can this happen?
Yeah, I think, and it's interesting that both the minister and the Taoiseach came out this week and said basically our child protection services are robust and fit for purpose, and I don't think that's the case. I think there's a lot of good work. I think, to be fair to our colleagues in the child protection services, the difference between Tusla and what went before Tusla is night and day. They are significantly improved, and it's important to highlight that. I think there is a problem though, Brendan, on two levels, and this is where we need the kind of structural reform that Caoimhín Gallagher, who's the child rapporteur, has been calling for. So the first thing is there's a difficulty in the child protection services at the moment in dealing with mobility. So if you're in a, like when Tusla was set up, we still had a scenario in Ireland where a lot of disadvantage was very spatially concentrated in particular areas where the services were very well represented, the schools were on alert. Because of the way the housing crisis has affected Ireland, we see amongst very disadvantaged communities, and they're not by no means the only people with child protection, but we see a lot more mobility because people can be evicted relatively quickly and move on. And if they move out of county up the country, it's very easy for child protection.
So the system's very localised, is it?
It's very localised in how it operates. It's very easy for child protection to lose sight of them. The other thing, and this is highlighted by, I think, what the Social Workers Association was saying this week, the model is still very dependent on engagement, on the family engaging with services, and then those services, as Tanya said, reporting back. When I was doing my research in Limerick back in 2007, 2010, what was really evident was some of the most vulnerable families were very, very reluctant to engage because they were very fearful. They were particularly fearful of social workers because they had their power to take their children off them. And our structures at the moment do not adequately address the need for of children where the families are very reluctant to engage.
Okay, but Tanya, there is a balance to be struck here, isn't there, in terms of like that the family is the best place for a child. How much does the state interfere in a family? Where is that line?
And children want to be raised by their families, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where they want. They don't want to be taken away from their families. In fact, when children do want to be taken away, you know, it's very serious for them to make that decision. There is a really complicated standard, you know, in the constitution here. And TUSLA can only really intervene when a parental failure happens, where there's a real instance of neglect, abuse.
Which is as it should be, though, is it?
That's right. So really what matters here, and as Niamh said, it's night and day with the child protection services the way they were before. What you find at the moment is where there is enough social workers in place, where there's enough people to deal with the demand, you find the people are generally very happy with the social worker service they get, the children and the parents themselves. Where there are shortages of social workers, you find huge numbers of cases sitting on the social worker's table and very quickly them dealing with huge amounts of risk and trying to get to vulnerable children. The other problem, and this comes back to your point, families don't always want to deal with social workers, they're afraid. But who they do want to deal with is early intervention services, such as public health nurses and GPs and people that can come and help you. There's a lovely project, the Community Mothers Project, where it's mums who've raised children themselves that come out and help families.
So trusted networks in the community that people do not see as a threat to their
family.
That's
it, but they're not being invested in. So I can tell you, for example, in the north inner city at the moment, which has a high concentration of homeless accommodation, there are not enough public health nurses to deal with the kind of needs and demand. So this case is really important, and Kyron Dernan's case is really important, because it's not just about the role of TUSLA, it's also about the other actors in a local community and the role that they have to play in child protection. And that's what I'm hoping comes from this case, to be honest. Not some quick response checking on doing welfare checks. We have a broader look at what those early intervention services look like.
And everyone knows the community nurses, for saying new mothers and everything, are an absolute lifesaver and they do get let into the house.
And that's it. And for all mothers, to be honest, every child has, you know, deserves to have a public health nurse doing those checks and, you know, making that contact with TUSLA if necessary.
Okay. Lots more to get to, but look, we do the budget and the economy are starting to come into focus, Peter. And the Business Post has a kind of alarming story on the bottom of the front page today. 10 billion budget swing pushes state to brink of first deficit since COVID. I'm all thinking, deficit? We don't do budget deficits in this country. We just keep spending and still have more left at the end.
Yeah, well, we are going to do budget deficits. You know, it's a bit sensationalist, that headline, because the Apple money's in the 10 billion, you know, so it's,
yeah,
it's a little
and
bit
it's also taking into account investment in infrastructure and all that as well.
So the important messages here are, one is also this article here in the Sunday Business Post that the American investors have been warned by high-level government, right, that Ireland has got a chronic infrastructure deficit, high labour costs, high operating costs, burdensome planning permit system and high income tax. Now, the IMF have come out and said Ireland's got a 32% infrastructural gap between a like economy. 32% we're behind any like economy in terms of our infrastructure, and a 27% quality gap. We've got situations here where the government spending is up 8.5% year on year. There was a target set in 2021 that wouldn't go above 5. So we've got a period, right, of 10 years where we had a lot of money and we haven't solved, you know, we've been on this show before talking about the children's health and children's, the infrastructure and health there. We haven't solved that problem with all that money. The health service, 9 out of the last 10 years, the health service budget is massively overrun, which shows a total lack of planning, total lack of ability to budget properly in terms of that. So we're heading here into a budget, right, where we've massive infrastructural deficit. That's the first point, right? We've got an awful lot of short-date spending is based on the cost of living, right, supports. Now, cost of living is a problem in this country because you solve cost of living by decreasing demand. When people stop spending on stuff, prices come down. But unfortunately in Ireland, there's a huge amount of wealth, 155 billion worth of cash sitting in banks that is earning less than the rate of inflation. And people want to spend that because they perceive it's losing its purchasing power. So we can't get this consumer demand to dip, right? No matter what the prices are.
Because some people have too much money.
But no matter what the prices are, people are buying it. People okay. are buying it, right?
So look, so that's the diagnosis. What are the most important things? No, actually, forget that. What are we looking into in the next couple of years? Are we looking at a complete change in the financial mood music in this country?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely. That's exactly
this
what we're
whole
looking
kind
at,
of like right? everything's fine we've, that we've got used to a bit now. Yeah. That's over, is it?
That's over. That's over in my book because of the infrastructural spend that's needed. Right. If we want to continue to, okay. to attract foreign direct investment, we need to spend heavily in infrastructure, which means
cutting our cloth in day to day spending.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Which we're not great at in recent years. Okay. We leave that there and I'll take a break. Jack Horgan-Jones, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Peter Brown and Tanya Ward staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Jack Horgan-Jones, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Peter Brown and Tanya Ward. And we don't have a lot of time left. There's a couple of other things I want to get to quickly. Niamh, a student in the Irish Mail on Sunday, as a student I'm saving thousands in rent by sleeping in my van. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so obviously I'm a registrar in a third level college and I went to college in the 90s. Going to college was brilliant. It was like this fantastic rite of passage. It's still a tremendous privilege for our young people, but the trauma out there because of the housing crisis and the difficulty. And this particular story is about a young fellow who's sleeping in a van while he's doing his law degree in the University of Galway. But one of the things that's you know, there is a gender difference here because there's a safety issue for students who are, and there's a lot of couch surfing going on. That's creating all kinds of issues. The other thing is, I think, you know, the government is going to say, well, we've our rent of room scheme. Rent of room scheme is like the Wild West out there in terms of what's being offered. Some of it's amazing, some of it's appalling.
Okay. And I beg your pardon, that's in the Sunday World by Eugene Masterson. Jack, briefly, what do we learn with the extracts from Leo Varadkar's new book in the Sunday Independent today?
So there's three of them. He goes into the Leo the Leak controversy, which I'm sure everyone will remember. And the interesting thing he says about that is he wonders, as he was given to wonder in his time in office sometimes out loud, he wonders in his darkest moments, he says, whether the slowness of the Garda investigation had something to do with the McCabe controversy. And his very outspoken stance
there's nothing
evidential there, but it's an interesting insight into his thinking. Yeah. And then another extract deals with, well, there's two other extracts. One deals with the infamous video of the kiss in the nightclub, just when he was about to become Taoiseach again, and takes you into his thought process around that and the reaction to that. And also, interestingly as well, the other person who was in that video and how Varadkar contacted him and something about what that person must have been going through. And then finally, the defenestration of Phil Hogan around the Golfgate incident and what happened from Varadkar's point of view, and as well revealing the nugget that himself and Phil Hogan are perhaps unsurprisingly not on speaking terms.
Yeah, and Phil Hogan is somebody who had been viewed as having done a lot for Leo Varadkar down the years, correct?
Well, I mean, a Fine Gael kind of grande and Sven Gali, and also someone who had, you know, achieved a really high position in Brussels as Trade Commissioner, and that's the extent to which the domestic political maelstrom took control following the Golfgate scandal that ultimately he was sacrificed on that altar.
Well, what surprised me about those extracts is how open he actually is about those events, because it doesn't sound like there's any spin on it actually, really, you know.
Okay.
And I was quite struck by the video and how he talked about the video, and what he was kind of saying was, you know, he actually appreciated the way the media actually treated it as a privacy issue. Even I know this show, I listen back to you, you did treat it very respectfully, and it was a major violation of his privacy.
You went back checking our record, don't do that. We're like first responders and things. We don't always get things right. We did our best on the morning. Okay, thanks be to God for that. I didn't realise the record was being checked. Peter, really quickly before we finish up, you are a huge fan of the Traitors, Ireland.
I'm a huge fan of the Traitors, Brendan. Yeah, and the thing I love about it the most, that if you took the 24 people the day before they go into the castle and ask them, do you believe you have integrity? They'd all say yes. And then a day later, they're lying on a professional level. It's stunning how good people are at lying. And I think it just shows us how much lying is actually going on in our day-to-day lives. If people are so good at it, right, they're incredible. People are incredible at lying.
Okay.
And that's the fascinating thing about it.
Yeah, you see, this is for you, a markets person. Like, you believe we're all basically under the thin veneer of civilization, that everybody is just a competitive animal underneath it.
Absolutely.
All, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks very much to our panel this morning. Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent of the Irish Times. Professor Niamh Horrigan, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College. Peter Brown, Managing Director of Bagot Investment Partners. And Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Thanks for a great hour, guys.